Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. Stay tuned for this hour-long 4th of July special.
July 4th is a day to re-examine our origins and to re-examine where we want to go from here, and that perhaps Bush, as what I call the gift in disguise, has enabled us to see a little more clearly. I say perhaps because I don't think it's for sure. Can enable us to see more clearly the direction we have to go. We have to be participants in our own future rather than passively watching what's going on.
That's the voice of Vietnam veteran turned peace activist Brian Wilson. He joins me in this hour-long 4th of July special. Stay tuned. Today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll explore the themes of patriotism, nationalism, and empire. On this Independence Day special, I'm joined by Brian Wilson, political activist and author who is currently writing a memoir of his life experiences from being in the Air Force during the Vietnam War to becoming a nonviolent revolutionary. In April 1969, Brian witnessed the destruction of a Vietnamese village and the killing of women and children by U.S. troops. This experience awakened him emotionally and politically. Brian Wilson became an anti-war activist, tax resister, and in the 1980s used his own body to block trains loaded with U.S. weapons headed for Central American killing fields. In 1987, a weapons train in Concord, California, rolled over Brian Wilson, severing both of his legs. He was the inspiration for the making of a documentary film, The Healing of Brian Wilson, which looks at the suffering of the peoples of Central America and is narrated by Chris Christopherson. Brian Wilson's many articles on U.S. foreign policy and nonviolent action can be seen on the World Wide Web at www.brianwilson.com. That's Brian Wilson with two L's .com. July 4th is Brian Wilson's birthday. Welcome to the program, Brian Wilson, and happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin by just talking a little bit about some of your life experiences. You grew up on the East Coast in upstate New York and had a fairly average childhood, would you say?
Yeah, I'd say it was pretty average. I lived in a farming community, and my parents were, conservative, like most people would have been considered conservative in those days. My parents were very religious. And I think my father maybe was a little further to the right than most fathers that I knew in town. But, you know, as a kid, I wasn't really assessing the politics of my parents or any of the other people. I was just growing up with other kids in that town. But it was, you know, a town of 350 people surrounded by farms. So it was basically a rural conservative community, and everybody I knew was pretty much in the same thinking field.
In your, you were the class valedictorian of your elementary school, and you write this in your biography that at your eighth grade commencement ceremony, your speech was stressing the importance of good sportsmanship, especially for those who found themselves physically handicapped. I'm curious, at that young age, did you ever envision that one day you'd lose both of your legs?
Of course, no, I didn't. It did turn out to be a little prophetic. But that's the way life is sometimes. So life can be prophetic, and certainly it takes turns that one cannot predict in advance. In those days, I was just becoming an athlete, so sports was becoming very important to me, and I guess that's what motivated me to write the talk for my commencement. But of course, I was not thinking that I was going to be, in any way handicapped. I mean, you don't think that way when you're young.
Yeah, you said that life takes some interesting twists and turns that we may not predict, and one of those for you in 1966 came when you were drafted into the military. Maybe you can talk about that experience and how it changed you.
Well, I was for the war. I was a graduate student at the time with a 2S deferment. This was pre-lottery. For those that might remember what life was like before the volunteer army like we have now. So pre-lottery meant everybody was, virtually every male over 18 was subject to conscription. And if you were in school, most students had what they call the 2S school deferment. So in 1966, I was in school, and I was kind of shocked to get my draft notice because I thought I was exempt while I was in school. However, I didn't have any political opposition to the war or any religious reasons to oppose it, so I enlisted in the Air Force officer program rather than go into the Army, and wound up going, I think I went in and actually started my 4 years in September of 1966, which enabled me to finish I was drafted in January of 66, so I was able to finish my semester in law school, and actually went to summer school as well, until I actually had to report in September, and then that started a four-year tour in the military, and 2 years very soft plush assignment in headquarters Inspector General's staff in Washington, D.C., and then a very unusual assignment to for an Air Force officer to go to Vietnam by way of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, in 12 weeks of Ranger training with a unit of 40 men. And then on to Vietnam in March of 69.
What were your first impressions of Vietnam when you arrived there?
We first landed at, as I remember, Cameron Bay, which was relatively uneventful, but almost immediately, within a few hours, my unit and I were flown to a little base called Binh Tui, which was like 100 miles south of Saigon in the Mekong Delta, and we landed after dark, and the pilot of the plane was shouting at us to get off the plane as fast as possible because he saw flashes, assuming that that meant mortars were coming in, and sure enough, the explosion started as we were rapidly exiting the plane. Somebody at the base that was greeting us was escorting us into bunkers. The sirens were going off and you could hear the explosions, and that was pretty much my introduction to Vietnam. So it was like, wow, it's for real.
One of your assignments in Vietnam was to kind of go out into the fields after the pilots had strafed some of these villages. And in April of 69, you had an epiphany that changed your life. Maybe you can tell us about that experience.
Yeah, it's another one of those things that when I think about it, it's like, well, how could that have happened to me? I actually was asked by the Vietnamese-based commander at Binh Tui to do an extra duty to do a favor for him, to go with one of his lieutenants to villages after airstrikes, primarily in this area at that time by South Vietnamese pilots who had been trained in the United States. And apparently there was some rumor that they were missing their targets, and I didn't even, quite frankly at the time, think about what the targets were. I mean, it wasn't that important, I guess, at the moment to actually to question what the targets were. But as soon as we got to where the grid coordinates were, where we were going, where the bombing mission had occurred, and the Vietnamese lieutenant was kind of guiding me because I didn't know the area like he did, there was a village that was a target, and we were there within 15 minutes after the bombing, and it was very painfully obvious that virtually everything in the village, and these villages were not very large, probably the size of a baseball stadium, kind of mounds in the rice paddies, 100 to 200 residents living there. And all I saw was corpses on the ground of either water buffalo or children or young women or a few elderly, and smoke coming up from whatever buildings had been there. Certainly no substantial buildings other than basic, very humble Vietnamese housing. And I was kind of in shock, realizing that the target was just basically a village. And clearly there were no defenses, military defenses of the village. There was no weapons, no guns, no anti-aircraft. And in fact, didn't even see any small arms lying around on the ground. These were people who were basically rice farmers. And the young men were absent from these villages during the day, either further out in the fields working, or they were in the South Vietnamese Army, or they were in the Viet Cong Army. Within a minute or two of entering the edge of the village, I, you know, looked down just in order to walk and realized I was about to step on a young woman who was holding, had tried to hold three young children in her arms. Obviously, in my mind at the time, she had been trying to flee the bombing. And they'd all got caught in napalm, which was usually the final bombing run was napalm to catch anything that hadn't been hit before. I was struck by looking at her face, because her eyes were open, and I thought maybe she was alive, and I bent over to, I don't know what I was doing. I was in shock. And I realized that she was dead, and that the napalm had melted the skin off of her face. And I started actually throwing up and vomiting, and then I started kind of heaving, I think kind of a crying, a combination of heaving and vomiting. And the Vietnamese lieutenant asked me what was my problem. Many years later, when I actually had my flashbacks to these scenes, in 1981, actually, I remembered him asking me what was my problem, and I responded with kind of a startling response, to certainly to him and even to myself. Upon reflection, I said I was looking at the death of my family, and that this could be my aunt or my sister or my own children. And he laughed and said this was a victory over communism. And I knew at that moment that something had happened to me that I didn't know much about. It was in hindsight, it was an epiphany. It was a dramatic paradigm shift that I didn't really fully grasp at the time, except that I knew I was in a different place. And I had to go through four more villages in the next couple of weeks after that, observing the same kind of scenes. So in like a three-week period of time, I witnessed almost 900 basically murders of civilians in five different villages in Phong Dinh and Vinh Long provinces in the Delta. So that was pretty much the end of my all-American kind of upbringing and belief in my country. And I spoke out against the war. I spoke out against the bombings mostly. When I realized that virtually every village in the region where I was located in the Delta was identified as a target and was systematically being eliminated through bombing missions day after day. And in officer training school, I had to study the Nuremberg Principles, which are incorporated in Military Regulation 27-10, that you do not destroy civilians or civilian targets and infrastructure. And I was kind of naively believing that we were... initially, I thought that my superiors had been bombing on the basis of mistaken intelligence. And then I realized that, no, these villages were being systematically, deliberately targeted because all the Vietnamese in the Delta, if they were not working for the government or they weren't openly serving in the military directly or indirectly, that everybody else was presumed to be enemy. And the truth is, as I learned after several more months there, that virtually all the Vietnamese, even though they couldn't say so, really were very opposed to the United States being there. And although it seems like a no-brainer now, You know, we invaded the country, and why would they not be opposed to us? At the time, it was a process where I was just slowly registering that the whole war was based on a lie, and then maybe I needed to study our whole history once again to find out how this could be happening when, you know, we all, most of us, at least those of us in my upbringing and my circle, all believe so deeply in the values and quality of the country that we were born in. And all that mythology started unraveling for me, and then I had to kind of rebuild, especially when I got out of the military, rebuild my life around a different value system and a different paradigm.
I'm speaking today with Vietnam veteran turned peace activist Brian Wilson. He's joining me by telephone from his home in Northern California. July 4th is Brian Wilson's birthday. And unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of these scenes being replayed again and again with the war on terror and the subsequent U.S. invasion of Iraq. And I guess before we get to Iraq, maybe you can talk more about this epiphany and where it led you in your life. And you mentioned also the flashbacks that you began to have in 1981, and maybe you can talk about how those sort of solidified this epiphany that you described in 1969 and first experiencing there in the battlefield.
Well, when I got out of the military in 1970, actually I left Vietnam in 69. I was sent home early, actually. I presume because of my speaking out against the war, although nobody told me why I was being sent home. I was simply ordered back to the States early and said goodbye to my men. And I was under court-martial charges for the last year in the military, but no court-martial was ever convened, so I was, separated as a captain with an honorable discharge. Went back and finished law school in D.C., already had my master's degree, and discovered that I was definitely, in some way, I just kind of assumed that I would be able to resume in some way my plan to be a lawyer, though I knew that what I was going to do as a lawyer was likely to change dramatically. So I did finish law school, passed the bar, and started practicing criminal law in Washington, D.C., but then I discovered almost immediately that the protocol of the court, namely standing up for the judge when the judge comes in the courtroom and as the bailiff calls out, everybody rise, and then the flag that usually sits on a pedestal by the judge or on a wall behind the judge, those two things, the bailiff saying everybody rise and then seeing the flag, had tremendous emotional content I could feel in my body when I heard everybody rise and when I see the flag. And I reviled, and I didn't want to tell anybody. I didn't even want to admit it to my wife, who also was a lawyer, my wife at that time, because it seemed silly to me that I would be offended at the thought of rising, standing up when the judge comes in, because after all, that's the protocol of the court. I never really thought about it that much. And then seeing the flag associated with the judge, an authority figure, and so forth, that was, it really... It was, I can't even explain how intense the feeling was inside of me, and yet in my head I thought, this is silly. Why can't I adapt to the simple protocols of the court? Everybody that goes into court does this. But after 3 weeks, I had refused to stand up for the judge on three different occasions, and I was not trying to make an issue over this with the judge. It was a visceral reaction, and I didn't really want to deal with it. because I thought it was meant that I was really screwed up. And so I just basically walked out of the courtroom after 3 weeks and never went back. And had a number of interesting jobs and work engagements between 71, 72, and the time I had my flashbacks in 1981. And in some way, I believe that I had escaped the painful, the more deeply painful emotional scarring of having been a witness to and participant in horrible events in war, like some of my veteran friends that I knew had, in fact, several had committed suicide. And I thought, wow, I'm really lucky because I wasn't out in the boonies looking for people to kill. I was kind of sailing along in a way in the American system, American way of life, but I was politically had become a radical, and I also had, as I said, had interesting work of my own choosing up until 1981 when the flashbacks occurred. And then I realized after two flashbacks that were happened very close to each other in time, that emotionally I was going to have to deal with this whole issue of being a Vietnam veteran, which basically until 1981 I hadn't even told most people that I had been in Vietnam. I hadn't told most people I was in, hadn't even been in the military. As strange as that may sound, there was a certain amount of shame and a certain amount of embarrassment to having been so brainwashed and so unquestioning to have gone to in the military and then to go to Vietnam and then to witness the carnage before I had any questions about what we were doing. You know, thinking, gee, I thought I had been a smart kid. I thought I was one of those kids that was people could point to and say he was a success out of our town. And then I realized that I was, had basically been virtually disabled by the brainwashing. And so in 1981, when I had to deal with the psychic shock of having reliving 12 years after the fact, reliving being in these villages looking at these bodies and then going through the wrenching kind of psychic experience of grasping what all that's about and why do you have to go through it again, and dealing with the issues of the soul, I call them issues of the soul. So I had to get help, you know, I had to go talk to people, I had to find therapists, I found a rap group. The flashback actually happened in Massachusetts. excuse me. And so then I actually became involved with veterans issues and with other veterans, but did discover that I was somewhat guarded even in participating with other veterans until I knew where their politics were. It's kind of strange because at one level, the war, just having the war experience was enough to bond you with other veterans no matter what the politics were. But if you were to spend a lot of time with other veterans after I had acknowledged that I was a veteran, I did discover that I wanted to participate in some kind of a group activity, political activity, that in some way expressed the honest lessons that we had learned from war, or at least that I had learned from war, and was hoping that to find other veterans who felt similarly. And that's where a lot of the division comes among veterans, is that some veterans don't want to go to the deeper places that suggest questioning harshly, not just the war, but the assumptions behind the war and maybe the assumptions of the society and the whole mythology of the culture, because that's painful. And then there's other vets that I did find that felt exactly the same way I did, that we learned not only about a lot about what the war was all about and the lies behind Vietnam, but the lies behind maybe the whole mythology of America and the fact that we had to rebuild our own identity, our own humanity, with a whole new, kind of a new face, a new, a relearning of what it means to be a human being. And so, you know, it's actually a pretty profound process, and it's a healing process. It's a painful process, but it's also a liberating process. And if one has to live in an empire such as the United States, it's certainly better to be facing it with your eyes open and your mind open than, not easier, but better is what I say. So that you can actually be a truth speaker, and a at least not that you have the truth, but that you are seriously pursuing a truth process, having taken off the mask that you grew up with, that you didn't even know was there, and kept you from being more fully participant as a human being in a globe that desperately needs clearly thinking, more fully conscious human beings, especially from the West. And so, you know, growing up in the United States and being in the United States today is still, in my mind, a big challenge because, you know, of all the places that one could live on the planet, the country, the United States, which was always told to me as being the best in the history of the world and the greatest country on earth, is the one country that is in the most denial, one country that has caused, at least in the last century, more harm collectively and cumulatively than all other countries, including Nazi Germany, because we have a reach that goes everywhere. And to be aware of this and to try to address it both in your personal life choices as well as in your political expressions, it's very challenging. And it's especially challenging when one knows people like many in my own family who seem so dumbed down by the propaganda, and yet, you know, I went to the same schools with my relatives. We went to the same church. We had family picnics together. And yet we have such a diametrically opposed views about reality and what's going on in the world. It's kind of startling, but it also is humbling in a way because I was where they were, and they haven't had my experiences. And of course, I haven't had their experiences, but most of them never left home. So we're living in a society where, you know, we desperately need to be enlivened and emboldened. And perhaps Mr. Bush is, as I say, sometimes like a cosmic gift in disguise, that he so unmasked the really what George Kennan of the U.S. State Department had stated in 1948, which was not allowed to be made public. Kennan basically said, you know, we have a very small percentage of the world's population consuming a very large percentage of the world's resources, and we should not make any bones about that and adopt our policies accordingly. Well, that was never allowed to be that honest. Bush is now probably at a time when he believes he can get away with it, and maybe he will, but nonetheless, I think it's an opportunity from maybe from the goddesses and the gods to the human condition, especially the human condition in the United States, that takes the mask off and says, okay, now do you still want to be this way? Do you still want to maintain this way of life that depends upon stealing and murder and injustices here and elsewhere? So perhaps, you know, maybe we all need, the whole society needs to go through a flashback.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking today with Brian Wilson, a Vietnam veteran turned peace activist in 1987, a weapons train from Concord, California, headed to the killing fields of Central America, rolled over Brian during a protest in which he put his body on the tracks. He lost his legs in the incident. Maybe we can talk a bit about some of your activism. Some things came up while you were talking there, and I'm curious maybe if your sort of realization of the horrors that you had witnessed in Vietnam and were somewhat of a party to sort of fueled that activism and maybe led you in that path maybe to sort of make amends for the things that you had done earlier in your life?
Well, you know, sometimes I say that my life had been, I had been kind of skating through life in this country, which if you're a white male and even coming from a poor family like I had come from, was still being a white male and having graduated from high school and college were tremendous advantages. And if you knew how to play the game right in those days, you could kind of just assume that you were going to have the good life, meaning you were going to have a good, secure job, health care, and financial comfort. Those were the values that I grew up believing in, like many did. I think in some way what happened to me in Vietnam, you know, is kind of like, I sometimes humorously say, the Great Spirit was not going to let me skate through life as a good old boy, participant in the American way of life, that I was going to have to deal with reality, I was going to have to deal with justice, I was going to have to deal with thinking things through, questioning things, feeling things, meaning pain as well as joy. And maybe I would have not gotten it, meaning I might not have grasped the make-believe version and fantasy of the United States civilization if I hadn't been thrown into those villages. I don't know, but certainly my sensitivity and my awareness was kind of shocked into being in April of 1969. Whether it might have happened anyway through some other course, who could possibly know for sure? But certainly, I do have Vietnam to thank for waking me up.
Maybe it would be instructive to go through what happened in the 80s and your activism and the sort of repression that was meted down to you by the federal government. Can you maybe talk about that?
Well, you know, there were a lot of people. A lot of people had been active against U.S. policies for years, in not just in Latin America, but elsewhere. I started, I think, with the Nicaraguan Revolution in 79, and simply through reading about it, I was becoming more interested in getting to know a lot more about the details of U.S. foreign policy, and discovered that there were a number of people, of course, that already were involved. After my flashbacks in 81, and incidentally, the first flashback occurred at Walpole State Prison in Massachusetts, where I was interviewing prisoners as a member of the staff of the state legislature, investigating prison complaints. And I witnessed a guard, two guards, beating a prisoner on the cell block, on the very cell block, and the very tier that I was on when I was interviewing prisoners, which provoked the flashback. It was very scary at that moment, but that's what I was actually doing at the time the flashback occurred. So the flashback provoked me into being active with vets to process this whole war experience, which then led me to meeting vets that were getting or already were involved in political activities dealing with U.S. foreign policy, basically the continuation of the imperial policies and the lies. And so, like many others, I started participating in conventional lobbying activities, attempting to convince Congress to stop funding the contra-terrorists in Nicaragua and the El Salvadoran government, which was clearly a repressive police state government. If you read carefully and studied it, you knew something was terribly wrong with our policies because they were going against the interests of the vast majority of the people, the poor people in those countries who were trying to, you know, bring justice to their communities and their society. Something that's kind of a no-brainer once you realize how class and race and oligarchic structures work in the world. Something that you, of course, I grew up knowing nothing about. So I became more active in lobbying activities, and I didn't go to Nicaragua or Central America until 1980, January 86. It was the first time I actually went down. I had been giving lots of anti-U.S. policy speeches in New England, where I was living at the time, and certainly was lobbying local congresspersons and would make occasional visits to Washington, D.C. to do lobbying. But when I came back from Nicaragua in January or February of 86, after spending 2 months there, I was really pretty provoked. I had witnessed, after 1 week in Nicaragua, I had witnessed from, you know, 2 or 3 kilometers distant, 3 contra attacks on farming cooperatives near Esteli in the mountains, northern mountains of Nicaragua, and watched 11 horse-drawn wagons bring the bodies in open caskets to the cemetery for burial in Esteli. And that was very moving because I had kind of a mini flashback to Vietnam and those villages. So that was a kind of another profound synthesis of kind of Vietnam, 17 years of thinking about life in general, and being in Nicaragua and seeing these bodies and realizing, yeah, the United States, this is what the United States has always done. This is what the United States did to the indigenous people. This is what the United States did to African people. This is what the United States government and its economic structures has done basically to people all over the world and all over the United States in order to maintain this sense of riches and comfortable way of life, and how can this continue in my name and in our name? And so it was kind of all that was going on in my head, and people can disagree with my conclusions, but that's what was going on inside me, which then motivated me to come back to the United States and work full-time without a job, without anybody paying me, joining with other people who were also working full-time, and some of them were veterans, and we were simply living hand-to-mouth, talking to different groups wherever we could. That led to 4 of us veterans deciding to do a Veterans Fast for Life, a water-only, open-ended fast on the east steps of the Capitol building in Washington in protest of Reagan's policies in Nicaragua and Salvador. And we sat there for 47 days until we stopped the fast. We resumed eating after 47 days. And that's when later we discovered we had been identified, although this sounds bizarre, and it was kind of unbelievable to us when we discovered it later, but we had been identified by the FBI as domestic terrorist suspects. We knew that our office had been broken into. There was an office set up for the fast by our support people, and we knew that where we stayed and had kept some of our personal records of some of the people around the country that were corresponding with us, records were stolen out of our house. We didn't know what to make of it at the time. You know, theft of our office on Massachusetts Avenue, and a break-in and theft, and then a break-in and theft at our residence where we were temporarily staying in Washington. But that was explained later, or at least seemingly explained later, when we discovered that the FBI had identified us as terrorist suspects. Now, why would they identify us as terrorist suspects? Well, apparently what had happened was that they had discovered 500 different locations around the country where people were participating in civil disobedience actions in sympathy with or in solidarity with the veterans' Fast for Life on the steps of the Capitol. So the FBI wrote that Veterans Fast for Life, the four members, had conspired to coerce the government to alter its peace policies in Central America by advocating civilian resistance throughout the United States. So that's how that's the language they had used when I saw the FBI report later. And that actual identification of us as suspects was the explanation a year later of why the train did not stop when I was on the tracks. And I was on the tracks with two other veterans. One of those other two veterans was also a member of the Veterans Fast for Life, also identified as a terrorist suspect. And so, you know, when the train accelerated on September 1st, 87, and then didn't stop, which it had never done before, and there had been other blockades, even blockades in the 60s, it was always a mystery to myself, who's not a conspiratorial thinker, certainly not innately, why did they do that? Well, when I was in the hospital, the very first investigator that came to talk to me after maybe 10 days in the hospital, when I was fully awake and talking at the time, with my lawyer present, one of the first questions this investigator asked me, which shocked me, was, when had you begun planning to hijack the train? And I thought, hijack the train? You know, first of all, I had become pretty committed to Gandhian nonviolence and wouldn't have even thought about hijacking. Somebody else might have thought about it, but I wouldn't have thought about it, and I certainly would not have agreed to participate in anything that was a hijack attempt. And that was a kind of a clue to me and to my lawyer that they had developed a scenario based on FBI reports of a behavioral pattern that would be consistent with what their image of a terrorist was. And, you know, between the fast in 86, which ended on October 17th, and the being hit by the train in 87, September 1st, almost a year, you know, I and others, we'd been back to Central America probably six times, gathering tremendous amount of evidence about what was happening in both countries with U.S. dollars directly funding campaigns of terror and murder and brutality and torture. We'd interview torture victims. We'd be in villages after attacks, you know, interviewing the survivors. We gathered tremendous amount of information. Also, during the fast in 86 was when the Iran-Contra controversy was first exposed when the Sandinista government army shot down a plane that was dropping supplies to the Contras in Nicaragua. And one man survived the crash, and he spoke in out when he was captured, saying he was working for the CIA and dropping supplies to the Contras. And of course, the government denied knowing him or in any way acknowledging that there was a CIA dropping weapons plan. And when we went to Nicaragua after the fast in 86, we spent a lot of time with this man in his jail cell. We also went out with him to the crash site. And that was another a bit of information that the government used, saying that we were part of a conspiracy to basically thwart the U.S. government's plans to bring peace in Central America. And of course, we were interested in obstructing the U.S. plan, because the U.S. plan was not a peace plan. It was a plan to continually maintain the oligarchic structures against the wishes of the majority of the people there. But that was another bit of information that the government was very fascinated with as to why I had spent time with this CIA agent who had been shot down in Nicaragua. And, of course, I was interested to finding out more about what he was doing and why. So after the train assault in 87, I just, when I recovered, it took me a couple months to recover. Actually, I had, also have a severe brain injury from a skull fracture at the same time, and all my ribs broken on the right side, and my right arm was broken, and right shoulder was broken, and my right kidney was damaged, in addition to the double amputation below my knee. So, I mean, I was pretty banged up. But by the end of 1987, I was basically resuming my activities and have, pretty much walked the same kind of course since, although I have integrated a lot of more Buddhist thinking and right livelihood practice with my more overt political expression.
Maybe we can wrap up with that. But first, I'd like to get your comments on some recent issues concerning the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And again, I just want to remind listeners, today I'm speaking with Vietnam veteran Brian Wilson. You can read his essays and articles on nonviolent action on his website, www.brianwilson.com, and Wilson is spelled with two L's. Bob Graham, a journalist in Iraq who writes for the London Evening Standard, published a story in mid-June titled, "I Just Pulled the Trigger." This is an eye-opening expose of some of the American GIs who are stationed in Iraq and have been executing that war. The article reveals the callous nature of some of their attitudes about a war they don't understand and they've begun to sort of resent. Maybe you can reply to some of their quotes. I've picked a few from the article. This is from Sergeant Meadows. He writes, "For me, it's like snapshot photos, like pictures of maggots on tongues, babies with their heads on the ground, men with their heads halfway off and their eyes wide open and mouths wide open. I see it every day, every single day. The smells and the torsos burning, the entire route up to Baghdad from 20 March to April 7th. Nothing but burned bodies." Specialist Brian Barnhard, age 21, joins in. "I also got the images like snapshots in my head. There are bodies that we saw when we went back to Sakura, a place we'd taken. The bodies were still there, and they'd been baking in the sun. Their bodies were bloated three times the size." Sergeant Quinones explains, "There are psychiatrists who are trying to sort out their problems, but they say it's because of long combat environment. They know we need to be taken away from that environment. But the group's tour of duty has been extended, and the men have been forced to remain as peacekeepers." Corporal Richardson said, "Now they're in this peacekeeping. We're always firing off a warning shot at people that don't want to listen to you. You make up the rules as you go along." The article actually exposes some further disturbing statements and some attitudes that some of these guys have, downright racist and hateful attitudes towards the Iraqi people. I'm wondering if you can draw any parallels from these kinds of statements that are being made today in Iraq with what you witnessed in Vietnam. And what, you know, they say that there are psychiatrists there, but what sort of help is there for this kind of trauma for these young men?
Well, this behavior is typical of wars. I mean, it's not unique to the United States. It's not unique, right now in Iraq. We should understand that we are a racist nation, and so most of us grow up with racist views. Even those of us who think we're fairly liberated, it's very difficult to be totally free of this deep-seated prejudice. But it's certainly common in our culture. And it's been common, I would submit, from our very origins when we called indigenous savages. I think if you were to read some of the accounts of campaigns even against the Indians during the Revolutionary War, for example, in upstate New York against the Iroquois, the language that was captured in some of the memoirs that have been discovered basically describe very similar language and behavior that we're seeing, that we saw in Vietnam, that we saw in the Philippines, in the Spanish-American War, in Iraq today. So this is fairly common behavior in war. It's one of the reasons why war is a device that should be abolished. I mean, war is not something that can be reformed. It's not something that can be controlled with international law, which I discovered in Vietnam. The Nuremberg Principles just totally ignored. Everything goes in war. And in terms of how men and women that are thrust into these situations can be helped or healed, I mean, it's a big challenge because, in my opinion, the only real or the most likely route to some kind of healing requires a real honest assessment of what the reasons for the war were in the first place. Almost always have nothing to do with the rhetoric that has been presented to you, to your nation, or to you as a soldier. You have to come to grips with the fact that you, in some way, have been brainwashed. It's kind of like hitting bottom as a drunk. You really have to realize that you have been part of something that is pretty awful, and that you've got to say that you really were ignorant, and that in some ways you were, committed crimes in this ignorant state, and you have to kind of go through a forgiveness process. And that's, to me, that's the healing process that brings people from the madness of war into being peacemakers. But it's not easy. And you also have to kind of acknowledge everything that you've done and kind of at some point start recognizing that you and the enemy are one. You really are all part of the same family. I don't know how you get there in each case. And it would depend on each soldier in terms of how badly they wanted to kind of come to some different place in their life. Because in some ways, these soldiers may not have anything particular to look forward to other than staying in the military. Maybe some of them now want to get out of the military. What do they do when they get out of the military? They haven't been trained for anything, probably. Now they have these mental scars. If they want to get out of the military, they probably will be motivated to do some healing. If they want to stay in the military, they probably are going to have to be monitored closely by their superiors to see if their behavior can be still somewhat tolerated. You remember last year this series of murders at Fort Bragg, mm-hmm. with soldiers that had come back from Afghanistan. There were four soldiers that had all killed their wives. And three of them had certainly been in Afghanistan, and the military psychiatrists were very alarmed as to what had happened to these men, how desensitized had they become, and how can you now resensitize them? Well, when you put people through horrible circumstances and they're thrust into situations where they have to kill people and maim people and witness lots of corpses, it is something that makes one pause as to how you do set up some kind of a process by which these people can be healed, because they're all going to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, every one of them, which have very specific symptoms. And the question is whether they're going to, whether the treatment's going to be made available to them, whether they're going to be wanting to participate in the treatment, and how badly the society wants to welcome them as soldiers who participated in what will be seen subsequently as another war based on lies, if you don't already understand it now, and then the soldiers having to deal with the fact that they had to go through this experience all for lies. Now, what do you do with that one? You see, then you have to deal with not just the trauma, but the fact that you were traumatized for a fiction.
I'm speaking with Brian Wilson, Vietnam veteran, anti-war activist. We have a few moments, so I'm wondering, on your birthday, July 4th, as Americans embark on the celebratory rhetoric of freedom and liberty and democracy for all, what should people be doing if they want to be a patriot?
Patriot comes from the word patria, fatherland, fatherland. We might actually be past the point where we need to be talking about patriotism, because we really need to be talking about how do we be a global citizen but living in a local community. And our community, for the listeners, is the United States, and specifically Santa Cruz in this case. How do we be a global citizen living locally? Well, it seems to me we have to realize that we're all part of the same family, and therefore we have to be very vigilant and critical of U.S. policy that does not honor this respect for other nations and other peoples, and therefore we have to, in a way, start thinking about having our first genuine revolution, the revolutionary process in this country based on justice. The Revolutionary War that we had, that we talk about, that we study as kids, was not a revolution based on justice for people. It was based on essentially a freedom of colonists that lived here from the tyranny of a monarchy from England. I mean, and there's a justice in that. There's a justice component in that. In that, of course, but it wasn't designed to bring equality and justice to all the people that lived in the colonies. In fact, it was a very oligarchic structure from the very beginning. And I think we need to now recognize that we have to have a nation that's based on justice, and we should declare our independence from a government that has gone stark raving mad, our own, and begin rediscovering what it means to be a citizen of the planet, but living locally. And that means that the policies that our national government has been participating in, not just under Bush, but for the most part for the last century, are policies that are designed not to bring peace and security to the world, but to bring basically instability and war making. And so I think that July 4th is a day to re-examine our origins and to re-examine where we want to go from here, and that perhaps Bush, as what I call the gift in disguise, has enabled us to see a little more clearly. I say perhaps because I don't think it's for sure. Can enable us to see more clearly the direction we have to go. We have to be participants in our own future rather than passively watching what's going on. And I think that there's a chance for a quantum leap here. And the alternative to a quantum leap probably is going to be extinction. When I say a quantum leap, I mean a quantum leap in consciousness. So I think this is an incredible moment to be alive. It's actually an incredible opportunity to be witnessing the darkest of the dark, and perhaps the birth of a new kind of paradigm, which provides us the hope of a sustainable future rather than one that's doomed by greed, power, war, oligarchic structures. I think the human condition has the capacity and the necessary components to make totally different choices than what we've been making in the past, and only time will tell. But I always like to think of July 4th as a day to re-examine the whole paradigm and assumptions that our country was based on. And we were based on, our country has been built on violence and death and injustice. And I'm sorry to say that, because that's not what I really want to say about my country, but I don't know how else to proceed but to start out with the truth as I see it, so that we can walk a different path with great enthusiasm rather than with our heads down.
Been speaking with Vietnam veteran U.S. tax resister and anti-war activist Brian Wilson. You can read his many articles on U.S. foreign policy and nonviolent action on his website, www.brianwilson.com. That's brianwilson.com. Brian Wilson, happy birthday. July 4th is your birthday. I want to thank you for joining me today on Rockin' the Boat.
Thank you very much.
That's going to wrap it up. We are fresh out of time here. I want to thank you for listening. Join me again Monday for another edition of Rockin' the Boat, back to a regular 30-minute format.